You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today, oral historian Craig Taylor, learns about a place by listening to its people. In his previous two books, he spent several years listening and speaking with the residents of his geographical subjects, getting to know their loves and passions, their fears and dislikes, how their community has changed or stayed the same during their lifetime. His first book, Return to Aikenfield, documented the changes in a rural English Suffolk community over the past 30 years, changes that has threatened the agricultural backbone of the economy and the future viability for generations ahead. In his bestseller, Londoners, as the book's subtitle suggests, he was able to draw out the loves, the hates, the lives, and those who want to leave, others who long for what has changed for good or ill about the British capital. And in his latest book, New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time, the Canadian native does the same with New York City. And New Yorkers had no English reserve in sharing their opinions. Through the book, Taylor speaks with cops and crooks, nurses and doctors, those living on the edge and those who cater to Manhattan's super rich, window cleaners, artists and activists, a Macy's Thanksgiving parade balloon captain, new immigrants and lifelong New Yorkers who lived through 9/11, the financial meltdown, Hurricane Sandy, and now COVID. It's a vivid picture of New York through the eyes of a few of its average citizens among the 8 million people who call the city home. Craig Taylor is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Craig Taylor, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
New Yorkers is your third book of oral histories about a place and time. Why did you choose this method of storytelling, and what does it reveal?
I'd always been a huge fan of some of the great oral historians of our time, obviously Studs Terkel, Ronald Blythe, the English writer who wrote Aikenfield, as well as Svetlana Alexeyevich. And her books. And so it just seemed like this wonderful way of getting to a place and allowing a lot of different voices to coexist in one project, a lot of different people that could argue with each other in the book, who could voice different points of view. And for me, it was just like writing novels with 70 or 80 narrators, all of whom just happened to be real people. So it was always a compelling and really wonderful form to me.
But with all those different people, everybody has different opinions and often diametrically opposed opinions. So what does it reveal about the place that you're ostensibly wanting to learn about?
It provides an effect almost. It just shows that there are so many different voices. You're never going to capture every single voice in New York, obviously, but it hopefully gives a reader a sense of just how packed a place like New York is, how many different voices are speaking there at once, the age groups, the nationalities, races, all of these different types of people are there, and this form just allows them to have their say and disappear or reappear. That's what I also liked about the oral histories. You could have people coming back in, so you could tell longer stories too over the course of a few years.
Now, that's one of the interesting things about New Yorkers is we meet some people at the beginning of the book that come back sometimes several times. Has that always been the case with your previous books, or is it something particular about New Yorkers?
It was particular to this one. I just couldn't shake some people. It was wonderful. They say that New York is a city of implication, and I certainly found that some of the people I met through this project just remained in my life. They're still in my life to this day. And so I was really keen to write a book that showed how time is spent in New York too, and how people's lives change over the course of years. And there are some people who go through a lot in this book. One gentleman is I interview about Hurricane Sandy and his experiences in the floodwaters. And by the end of the book, he's also been involved in this pandemic as well. So I was just very happy to be able to spend that amount of time with people.
Now, New Yorkers is the latest of your third book. You've done the same with Londoners. Again, you're not a Londoner. You're not a New Yorker. You didn't grow up in Suffolk, England, which was your first book about rural life there. Was it easier to draw out New Yorkers than your subjects in your previous books? We know that Englishmen are fairly reserved and they don't open up all that well. Were New Yorkers different?
They most certainly were. And as you noted, I'm not from any of those places. I'm Canadian and I grew up on the West Coast. So I'm always just enough of an outsider, it feels like. The farmers in my first book thought I was just some strange American wandering around the fields of Suffolk. And And The Londoners, in my second book, I lived there for 13 years, so I certainly knew about the place, but it took a while to draw them out. And the New Yorkers I spoke to, more than 200 of them, they were very eager to just get going. You know, they were eager to self-mythologize. They were eager to talk about their experience, to sort of leave their impression. They loved, some of them loved the idea of setting down this account of their New York, of their struggles in this city. So in that way, it was easier, but that just meant I had more material at the end to go through.
I don't remember if it was you that wrote this or one of your subjects who said this. He says, you know, the thing about New Yorkers, and they use the metaphor of hitting. New Yorkers don't nudge you. They don't, you know, it's like when they want to tell you something, they hit.
That was from my introduction, and I certainly felt that. I was comparing it to the sort of insinuation that I felt in London. And there were just so many instances when I first showed up. I conducted the first interview in a bar in Midtown that's just famous for all of the photographs of the great boxers of New York history around. And I interviewed a boxer. And then I just started feeling like, you know, you get hit by smells in New York. You get hit by things. It is not something that insinuates in the same way that London does. So that was certainly an image that I wanted to get in the book.
The New Yorkers you interview are all loquacious. They all have opinions, and they're not shy about sharing them. I was struck by one of the universal refrains that I don't think everybody put it exactly like this, but nearly all of them had this sort of thought for anybody who'd lived there for any length of time. It's a very universal refrain just about anywhere. You should have been here 10 minutes ago. You know, this idea that, you know, oh, you think New York's great now, you should have been here 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever. That was the golden age. Is that pretty universal, you think?
It's the refrain that you hear again and again, no matter if you're speaking to a chef or if you're speaking to a recording studio engineer, if you're speaking to anyone, there's a sense that you have just missed it. And that, of course, is a good way of planting your flag in New York and saying, like, I am a true New Yorker because I was here. But I think that that's eternal. It's always, you know, there's always something that's happened there before. And I was certainly envious of these previous eras in New York. I would have loved to experience. But then at one point I looked around at all of these, you know, incredible people who were sharing the city at this time with me. And I thought, you know, Gay Talese or Joseph Mitchell or Studs Terkel, none of them got these people, this particular moment. So you just have to work with the New York you're given. And that was told to me many, many times. Just work with this city that you have, leave your mark, and then at some point you'll have to move on.
Now, is there any rhyme and reason for the people you decided to sit down and talk with? Or was it a matter of just who you could strike a conversation with? What's really interesting is the range of life that you talk to. You talk to everybody from somebody who inspects kids' heads for lice to, you know, landlord, cops, activists, nurses, obviously, with the pandemic, the guy that does security at the Statue of Liberty, a singer, but he's a blind guy and sees the city through smells. I mean, it's just such a wide range of folks that you spoke with. Was there any sort of rhyme and reason to figuring out the stories you wanted to hear about?
Well, I knew that I wanted a wide range, and what I've found helps me, and certainly helped with this project, is this list of verbs that I have that I've collected from somewhere, and verbs can be applied to New York, and so you could have cutting New York, cleaning New York, policing New York, and so I would go out and find people who enacted those verbs. I certainly didn't get to everyone on my list, but it provided some sort of framework that meant that we weren't just musing about the city, but we were talking about the specifics of its action. We were talking about how it is made and remade. Electrifying New York led me to an electrician who wires the Empire State Building. And though he was talking about wiring the Empire State Building, he also eventually was talking about the beauty of the city, the beauty of the heights of the city, and also the sense that we, as I said before, we do the work here and then we're gone. You know, he knows that he'd wired this beautiful building. It's glowing with lights, but 20 years from now, someone will have to redo it. And so that's what guided me, this sense of aiming for the practical and hoping for something that said more about New York.
Now, in Londoners, I believe you tried to speak with everyone from each, I guess, I don't know if you call them boroughs in London, but it's like, you know, the N17, N4, you know, all the various areas of London. Did you try to do the same with New Yorkers, every neighborhood or every part of the city?
I didn't get to every single, I don't think every single neighborhood is represented in the book, but I certainly went to most, and I certainly have all five boroughs, and that was, you know, that was the best part for me, was exploring these parts of the city that I had certainly never had familiarity with just on visits. And so there's a lot about Queens where, you know, a lot of the energy of New York is these days, a lot about the Bronx. There's certainly a lot in Brooklyn, and I definitely made it out to Staten Island because that's a very specific part of New York as well. So it was a great opportunity to spend a lot of time on the subway.
And I remember the person from Staten Island basically reflected the you know, you always hear this refrain that nobody thinks about Staten Island.
Yeah, some of the attitude, the underdog attitude came out. There's a young woman who talks about just what's happening there and what isn't happening there and why she had to leave. But yeah, I wanted people to be able to speak about their place, you know, their neighborhood. Neighborhoods are just so important in a city like New York, so that was definitely part of it.
One of the first people we meet in the book is really interesting. I alluded to him earlier, Frank Sr., who's listed as a singer. Only eventually do we learn, as he shares his story, that he's blind. He sees the city through, you know, what he hears and what he smells. I found him such an interesting way to start this story about New Yorkers. Why lead the book off with him?
I was really intent on beginning the book with the five senses. And so I really wanted to draw readers in. And Frank is an amazing person who I could have had him speaking throughout the book. I could have done a book on Frank, I think. But he, as you say, sees the city in a different way, experiences the city in a different way. And I think he gives an account, it's almost a historical account of the smells of New York, going from the stink of Times Square in the 70s and 80s, and he talks about the smell of the water around New York. He talks about all of the sunscreens going past you, you know, all these different flavors of people, and the sounds, too, of dominoes being smacked down, you know, on the stoops of some neighborhoods. So I just felt like he was living New York in such a vivid way and thinking about it in a way that was so different from my own sight-based experience that I knew I wanted to start off with him.
Mm. And what's interesting is you mentioned earlier that several of these subjects come back to us. One of the first, in part one, Nonstop Hustle, we meet a recent arrival. He'd come here from Arkansas, Antoine Shavers. He'd gotten a job working in Macy's and wanted to be a singer. And we also meet him towards the end of the book when it becomes evident that that dream is not going to happen. And what's really interesting is it doesn't matter what their profession is. There's this sense that something's going to break for them. And wherever they are in their journey in the city, it's to be part of something bigger that they see New York as being.
Yes, and I think with Antoine, you know, he's a great example of the fact that New York is not a passive element in any American's life. No American will say, "Oh, I've never heard of the place." You will always get a fierce reaction to it of some sort. They want to go there. They will never go there. They love it. They hate it. And I really wanted to include somebody who was traveling there, who was journeying there. And as you say, Antoine leaves Arkansas, takes that Greyhound to Port Authority, and wants to be a singer. He's working in other jobs. But months and months and months later, I meet up with Antoine again, and he is working at Macy's. And he's not singing professionally, but there is a moment in the book where he sings a hymn, one of the hymns that he would sing with his grandmother in Arkansas, to a couple of people who are in Macy's buying a suit for their father's funeral. And so in some ways, he's not at Radio City Music Hall, but he has chosen to come here, and he's living out a version of his dream, which I thought was very poignant and is true to the experience of so many people in New York.
My guest today is Craig Taylor. He's a writer and author of the bestseller Londoners, Oral Histories of Londoners, talking about their city. His latest book is titled New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time. It's published by Norton. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things that comes out in this book is the great income inequality that's a part of New York City, just like it is in many places in America, but certainly in New York City, you know, there's such a huge gap. And it was interesting to read about those that serve the super rich, private tutors, nannies, dog walkers, as well as those that serve the very poor. What sort of sense did you get from those folks that are that sort of the, I think one person wrote it best. This is what they're buying is your time because their time is too precious I believe I'm paraphrasing what they said. And it was really interesting, that insight about those that are serving this huge income inequality.
Definitely. And I was able to speak to a lot of people who are on that side of the equation, who are servicing, because, of course, the super rich in New York don't really want to talk and don't often have much of interest to say on this subject. And it's the people who are cleaning their apartments or making their lives run smoothly or nannying their children that have an insight into, you know, into this fragrant upper layer, which isn't altogether a happy place for a lot of these people with money in the city. That was certainly the case I got. And it was not always a happy place for the people serving them who felt that they were, you know, being asked to do a lot of tough jobs for not a lot of pay. And I think after the pandemic, too, have been wondering what New Yorkers' relationship with the super rich will be. A lot of these rich people have left the city. We don't know if they'll come back. So it was a very fascinating subject to see through the lives of those who were working for them. And then I did get to speak to people who were really feeling the sharp edge of New York and who were living in a kind of poverty that probably shouldn't exist in a city with that much wealth. And so I was intent on ensuring that their voices were heard. There's an individual in the book who's very special to me, and a recycler named Elliot Carter, who recycles cans. And his view of the city and what he was able to do to pull himself up off the street, I think, is a tale of resilience. It's far more important than the tale of a Wall Street banker making his millions. It just seemed like that, for me, was a very dramatic story to tell from New York.
Perhaps one of the most infuriating interviews in the book were two bankers talking about what it takes to live in the city. You did have two rich New Yorkers talking about life in the city.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're not even that rich. They're young. And
yeah.
So they're not, you know, and one of them speaks about the budget that his boss has to live in the city, which I cannot for the life of me remember the number right now. But to hear these numbers being thrown around, it is shocking, and that's part of being in New York, is being around what the nanny talks of as an obscene kind of wealth, this wealth that is hard to believe. And so that was definitely an important part to include in the book. But the nice thing about the form, as we've discussed before, is it's not me making a judgment on these people. It's them. It's these bankers talking about their lives in their own words.
Yes.
And so I'd rather leave it to them to tell their story.
Yeah, and the boss required, he thought you needed at least $25,000 a month to live.
There you go. Good luck to him, I say.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that does come out in this book in all sorts of ways is all of the stresses New Yorkers have had, not only the fact that it is an incredibly expensive city to live in, that, you know, everything from finding an apartment, getting a better apartment, finding a place to live, getting a job is so stressful, but also the major calamities that have befallen New York, everything from 9/11 to the pandemic most recently, but also Superstorm Sandy, the financial meltdown in 2008, and that's really taken a toll on New Yorkers.
Definitely, these are the big ticket items in this city. You know, this is what you live through, and the people there had stories about them, stories of resilience, stories of pride, of sticking around, of getting through this, even though, as is the case with the first responder I spent a lot of time with, who is actively dying slowly from an ALS-type illness that he incurred on the pile in 9/11. So there are those types of people there, but there's also countless New Yorkers that I spoke to who said, yes, definitely, I will leave if something bad happens. I will definitely give up New York and all its pleasures and all I love about it if something bad happens. But a terrorist attack, a hurricane, a pandemic, a financial crisis, come on. It has to be something big that happens for me to leave the city. So I did love that element of it, too, that, you know, we're going to get through this. We're going to live through this. The pleasures that this city affords, they're just so dear to a lot of people in that city that they're going to stick around until something big happens.
One of the most interesting interviews you did that sort of talks about the daily stress and the toll it takes is you spoke with a dentist. And a dentist says, I've never seen so many ground down teeth, people grinding their teeth, you know, jaw injuries from being so tense. And he said, it just comes in waves with every single one of these stresses.
That was a lesson I learned from the previous project, where, in order to talk about the kind of financial stress, I spoke to a manicurist who was able to talk about, you know, these people coming in, and instead of going on trips now, they were just getting their nails done. And I realized that, you know, the people that deal with the bodies of New Yorkers, they have an insight into how these bodies are changing due to the level of stress. So I did find a very fascinating dentist who was able to take me through just the grinding and the TMJ that happens to different groups. When the garment industry imploded, he had garment workers coming in who had been chewing on ice and chewing on their pens. And in the financial crisis, the bankers came in with ground down teeth. And so I thought that that was a more interesting way of getting at, you know, these crises by looking at their effects on the body. And he certainly was eloquent enough to talk about it.
My guest today is Craig Taylor. His new book is an oral history of New Yorkers, titled New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time, published by Norton. 75 or so interviews actually made the book, but I think you spoke to a lot more people than that in the course of your number of years talking to New Yorkers in the course of making this book. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one person that does show up, and you alluded to him earlier, was Dan Balso, who, when we first meet him, he's talking about, in a section called Crime and Punishment, where you talk to a car thief, a lawyer, a woman whose son has been incarcerated on Rikers, and then a painter who was incarcerated on Rikers. And Dan Balso is a personal injury lawyer who sort of works out of his car, and he became transportation for you. But we meet him at the beginning, and then he tells you the story of surviving Superstorm Sandy in the Rockaways. And then later, he is one of the first people who are among the first people who are getting COVID at the beginning of the pandemic. Tell me a little bit about Dan.
Well, Dan's my New York. You know, he's an outsized figure. I was lucky enough to run into him, and he was lucky that I was around to talk to for hours and hours and hours. And he would always just drive me to a new neighborhood in this beat-up minivan, and then sometimes he would have this factoid about the neighborhood in the Rockaways. He just told me the story of tying a sweatshirt to his daughter's wrist and pulling her through the floodwaters, and this just seemed to happen again and again. You know, he had just been part of these great New York moments. And then last March, when I was in the city, I was with Dan, and a few days after I left, he sent me an email saying, I remember this very vividly, something for the book in the subject line, telling me that he had COVID and was being hospitalized. And for him, the hospitalization was very serious, and we talked about it. It became a large part of the book. And for me, one of the most emotional parts of the book, because he at one point sets a chair down in front of him and addresses the chair as if it is COVID, as if it is the virus, and says, in effect, you think you're coming to this city, you think you're coming to New York City and doing this, you're not taking the city away from us. And it just, for me, really summed up the weird and wonderful resilience of these people. He imitates Mookie Wilson winning the 1986 Game 6 against the Red Sox, you know, running past the virus. He does all of these things that are just so New York, and for me it was just a very moving moment of someone's fight for their city.
Yet at the same time, he also calls a loved one and says, I'm going to call you back, don't pick up. He goes, I want you to be able to keep my voice.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that to me is a very moving moment, and it's also a very New York moment, because a lot of people there in the city remember office workers on 9/11 doing exactly that. So it's something that's in their minds, you know. So you call and you leave your voice. You leave your voice for your kids, your friends. It was a moving moment for me in the book.
We also spoke to two nurses, Amy Hughes and Siobhan Clifford, who, you know, were doing such heroic duty during those months when, you know, we really didn't know what the course of a COVID illness would be like, and so many people were dying, and, you know, occasional success, and you'd be able to have somebody leave and they would play Here Comes the Sun on the loudspeakers in the hospital. It's really quite moving.
Yeah, I was very lucky to be able to talk to those two, and they were able to discuss what, you know, we're already sort of forgetting, which is just the panic and the fear that these frontline workers were going through day after day. And I just knew that it was a person in New York who needed to have their voice in this book.
In addition to all the people you spoke to, there was one person that you became very close to, and that is a guy named Joe, who ends up showing up in the book a number of times. Tell us a little bit about Joe in our last couple of minutes.
Joe became a friend. I met him at a meal that gets served every Sunday on 16th Street. It's called the Welcome Table. And, you know, New York can be such a wonderful experience for a lot of people. It can enlarge people, but it can also really damage and hurt people. And I saw in Joe's life someone who was on that sharper edge of New York. He was living on the streets at the time. He's a Vietnam vet, and his life is not easy, and yet he's an incredible, compassionate human being who became a big part of my life in New York, who lived with me for a while and taught me a lot about, you know, about the city, about these elements of the city that you could walk past on the street, you know, you could overlook, you could avert your gaze from. And he did so, I think, with a lot of honesty. And he spoke to this this idea that sometimes New York is a place that you're trying to get away from and you're trying to get back to, in his case, an almost mythical version of Pittsburgh, where he's from. So the friendship was very important to me and brought me into the book. And I'm just very glad that I was able to tell his story as well.
It is a really moving tribute to the people of New York in the book New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time. You spent 4 to 5 years in New York talking with people. You spent time in London. Is this something you're going to continue to do about people and places and time?
I don't know. It's a wonderful way to learn to be a human being. You know, it's a great profession to have, just listening to people. We need it these days when there's not a lot of listening going on. So I'm really, you know, lucky to have stumbled across this. But I don't know where the next place will be. It's a big investment. Who knows? Maybe I'll head to Tulsa at some point. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, it is just such a schooling in what it is to be alive from all these people. So I'm thankful for that.
Now, one of the things you said is, I still have friends from these interviews that you conducted in New York, and these are people who are staying in touch. Is the same thing true for the earlier books in London and in Suffolk?
Less so. There are a few people in both of those books I stay in touch with, but less so, certainly. And the degree of involvement was just so much more in this. And I kind of wanted it that way. I wanted it to be more human. I wanted it to be just more about connection. And it turned out that way. New York is many things, but it is a place where, whether you want it or not, you will connect with people. And so I definitely was looking for that, and I found it there.
Craig, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for all the great questions, Rich.
Oral historian Craig Taylor speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book, following up on his bestseller Londoners, is titled New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.